I'd like to introduce first the various members of our panel. Is it a panel? Whatever the term is. First of all, as you know, President Fairbringer is to my right. To my left is Dr. Repp, who will speak from the viewpoint of theological education, viewpoint of curriculum, of Lutheran theological education. On the end, Dr. Charlemagne, who will speak from the world political scene. And to his left, Professor Danker from the World Mission Team. We'll all have our licks, but there are no rules against interrupting, so we'll try to make it as free and as informal as possible. We will go until 8:15, try to cut it off pretty close to that. Just a couple of announcements before we start. The changes in the advisees are Professor Fred Danker, Professor Barish and Professor Breimeyer's groups are to go to Dean Werfel's house, Professor Jones' group to Professor Brecher's house, and Professor Bowman's group to Dr. Fairbringer's house. And there will be no chapel this evening because the devotion will be held in the professor's home. That's the rest.
And Dr. Fairbringer, I wonder whether we couldn't start off with a brief review of the purpose of your trip and also the places which you visited.
There were mainly two reasons for my taking this trip. As you might imagine, for many years, I have had the conviction that the ministry is one of the great gifts of God to the church, and that if the church at home here in the United States is to carry on its mission properly, it needs not only to train its home ministry adequately, but it also needs to see to it that the church in the various missions that it founds has an adequate ministerial training program. And of course that is furthered by the rise in nationalism on the part of many Asiatic countries, and the trend towards indigenization of the churches in these countries. So I approached the mission boards, and particularly the board of directors of our church, to allow me on a sabbatical leave program to go to the various countries where there are ministerial training programs under our auspices or under the auspices of sister churches of ours, and to review these programs and to see whether the home church can and should do more for them in order to help the national church grow strong by having a good, strong ministry. And this survey was authorized by the board of directors. The trip that I took just now was the first step in carrying out this program. Then there was a second purpose, and that was on behalf of the Committee on Doctrinal Unity of our church. The committee had been given, I might say, worldwide responsibility at the last convention of our synod in St. Paul, and we realized that we need to have much closer ties with the churches in foreign countries, not only the missions, but also those churches which have for many years been independent and the missions which have grown into autonomous churches. So on behalf of the Doctrinal Unity Committee, I set out to establish a better liaison than we had had and to make sure that we have better communication and perhaps set up a program of more frequent visitation to achieve better understanding between the groups. Now you asked about the places that are... I suppose I can, in outline, sketch the trip. It's always a pleasure to do that, to relive it, as it were. You want me to go to the map? Yeah. Mr. Schistler has traced it here in black outline. Here you find St. Louis. On the 1st of December, I flew to New York, where I met Dr. Grum. And together, then, we crossed the Atlantic, going first to Rome, and then a short hop to Athens, and then... and then to Bombay from there. I can, I suppose you can imagine what a contrast I found between Rome and Athens and Bombay. Then for 7 weeks I was in India, largely in the southern portion of the country, in and around Nagarkoil, where our seminary is located. Although there I saw also four other seminaries of other denominations. From there, then I went to Australia. We stopped in Singapore and Jakarta. And in Australia, then I got to see the big cities in the eastern portion, the Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne, and Adelaide, where both the seminary of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Australia, which is in fellowship with us, is located, and also the seminary of the United Evangelical Lutheran Church of Australia. And then back up to Darwin and to the Philippines, where I spent most of the time in and around Manila, but then also went up to the northern field, the beautiful mountain city of Baguio. And from there to Hong Kong, where we don't have a seminary. In Manila we do. In Hong Kong we have a program for the training of evangelists. However, the missionaries there hope to complete the courses that they have outlined and that they have been conducting for 7 years now, in another 3 years, and then hope by means of colloquy to qualify some of the men who are now in this evangelist training program for ordination. From there, I made another, I made an attempt. It was really the second attempt. The first one I made tried from Manila, but the American consul wouldn't let me go. I tried from Hong Kong once more to get to the seminary of the Batak Church on Sumatra. But I got as far as Singapore, and then the flight was canceled, and I had to turn back and go to Hong Kong. Then to Taiwan, where we have a seminary, and over to Tokyo, where we also have a seminary. From there, I flew to Seoul in order to visit the men who just had reached Seoul, that is to settle down permanently, about 6 weeks before, and to see what their thinking is now on the aspects of the work that they want to do there and that they are called by the church to do. Then back to Tokyo and to Honolulu, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, and back to St. Louis.
Sir, I wonder if you could compare Las Vegas with Rome.
Well, in Las Vegas, I was nearly at the airport. I didn't get into town.
Well, President Fearbringer, Vice President Nixon is on a jaunt on his own and is having a few non-political troubles at the moment. I wonder if you noticed any antipathy toward the West or Americans in any area that you visited.
I've tried to think back, especially after seeing the telecast this evening about all the difficulties that have cropped up not only in Venezuela, also in Paris and Algeria and Lebanon, and all the anti-American feeling that's been expressed. But actually, I didn't run into any. Perhaps a slight bit on Taiwan, where folks thought that the Americans were perhaps asserting themselves a bit too much or weren't doing enough for the Taiwanese. In Japan, it seemed to me there was more indifference towards Americans than I found elsewhere. But in India, and particularly in Australia and the Philippines and Hong Kong, I experienced no anti-American feeling whatsoever. And also the newspapers that I read, and I tried to read as many as possible, didn't reflect it, except to some degree in Japan.
Now, you left shortly after Sputnik was launched. Was there any effect that you could notice on the native peoples of this accomplishment?
Not too much. There were references to it in conversations and also in the newspapers, but it seemed to me as if the people had the conviction that it was merely a question of a few weeks before the United States would also have a satellite in orbit, and that really much of the know-how had been gotten from us. The folks in India, and that's the country in which I was soonest after the launching of the Sputnik, were much more interested in our economic aid program than in technical advances.
You see any evidences of point four work?
Yes. one can't help see them, not only in the dams that have been built and the roads that have been constructed, but also in the people one meets. At Trivandrum at the airport, I met two Americans. One of them is an agriculturist from Kansas State College, who's been over there for almost 4 years, aiding the agricultural program of the Indians. And my sister told me that it really was noticeable that you could buy larger eggs now in India than you could just a few years ago.
Are we building the kind of things that these people need, or is there some truth to the accusation that we're spending a lot of money on things that can't actually be used over there?
What I observed was that the things are useful. Of course, there's very much road construction, particularly on Formosa, too. I suppose just about all the good roads have been built with the United States money, and they are very acceptable roads. And then the same with bridge construction and airport construction. But I felt that the agricultural and technical advisors were doing a very fine job and were really creating, among the rank and file of the people, rather than among the politicians, perhaps, a healthy, good feeling towards the United States. And where I was able to speak to industrialists or businessmen who were more than ordinary shopkeepers, I found that while they were critical of our foreign policy and frankly admitted that they couldn't understand it and said that much of it appeared foolish to them, they were appreciative of this Point Four program.
You mentioned the fact that you went over there also with the concern of representing the Doctrinal Unity Committee and the relations of our missions and the national churches abroad with other churches, which in turn are not in fellowship with us. When Bishop Monicum was here last December, he spoke of what he termed the inconsistency on the part of our church in India in being affiliated with the National Christian Council on the one hand, and on the other hand, being very hesitant about the entrance into the Lutheran Federation. Could you speak on that? Alleged inconsistency.
Well, I think it's bound to be the case that where there's a perhaps not only a young church, I'm going to say where there's a young church, that it'll have to find its way, and that many a time, as with the National Christian Council in India, we see advantages in working together with a group like that for the obtaining of passports or even for the obtaining of permission to enter the country or permission to return to the country, and that in some respects all of the implications are not always seen. It would also happen that if one step is made which is criticized, then I think we noticed that quite a bit in our own state and church officialdom too, that then a person tends to draw in and perhaps take the next step much more cautiously and with hesitation. And all that seems to point to inconsistencies, and perhaps to some extent is inconsistent. But I do believe that the men who are members of the Interchurch Relations Committee of the New India Evangelical Lutheran Church by and large know where they're headed for, and have charted a course which can be defended, too. Now, you have to tell me whether I answer your question or not, but I think that perhaps we can do a few more things in conjunction with the National Christian Council, although at the moment I don't have my fingertips all of its purposes. I think the men have been very careful with regard to the movement of joining the Federation of Evangelical Lutheran Churches, but I do believe that their discussions have shown that there is a possibility of taking membership, because the Federation of Evangelical Lutheran Churches in India seems minded to conform to all of the things which also we conceive of as proper in a federation of churches. So I'm really expecting that our church in India will be able to join that federation.
Could I go one step further then and ask about the plans for the proposed synodical conference in India, which would go beyond membership in a mere federation or council and would involve, as I understand, also pulpit and altar fellowship?
Those plans are moving ahead. The idea is this, that in the southern part of India, where the Tamil language is used, I might say in passing that there are 14 main languages in India. The government has tried to establish Hindi as the national language. And perhaps if you read the last issue of Time, you saw something about that again. It was supposed to be accomplished by 1965, but there has been quite a bit of discussion, particularly on the part of those who live in South India and who don't speak the Hindi, that English should be retained as the official language, because it's been that for 200 years. And now with these 14 languages, quite a bit of difficulty in communication exists, as you can imagine. Well, now in the Tamil language area, there are three Lutheran groups. The Tamil Evangelical Lutheran Church, of which Bishop Marnicom is the presiding bishop, and the Arcot Lutheran Church, which has Danish connections, and our India Evangelical Lutheran Church. These groups are endeavoring to get together to form, let's put it this way, to establish the basis for pulpit and altar fellowship, and then to form a synodical conference. Now, there are some difficulties, although we must say that much progress has been made. One is that a doctrinal statement needs to be developed as yet, that it needs to be set down and formulated. And another difficulty that needs to be considered is the question of the fellowship in which the various members of this proposed synodical conference have with churches in Europe, for instance, with the Danish church or with the Swedish church or the Leipzig mission. We are proposing that this question be studied not only in India but also here, since it would involve also us if this synodical conference comes into being. And the third difficulty, as it was put at the meeting, was the fact that, the way one of the men put it, the freewheeling bishop of the Tamil Evangelical Lutheran Church, who involved in quite a bit of activity outside the Lutheran Church, which sometimes also makes difficulties for his own church. But plans are moving ahead, and the discussions are to continue.
Well, you were in India now for quite a while. Now, we've heard that Christianity and communism are mortal enemies, and yet in the province of Kerala, communism has taken over, despite the fact that this was probably the most Christian province in India. What would be an explanation of that?
Yes, that's a difficult one to answer. I suppose Dr. Ravenkel, when he was over there, had his troubles with the communists, too. They're very suave, very polite people. I enjoyed particularly a question period with some 50 teacher training students at a teacher training school, in this communist country of Kerala, and I suppose quite a few of them have communist relatives, but some of them have communist feelings too. I really don't know just what to say to that, except that Kerala is the most advanced part of the country. I suppose the average income is the highest. In Kerala, you have the large tea plantations where the laborers organized and joined unions a long time ago, and where they felt that the British owners were not treating them properly. And so I think that they were perhaps more susceptible to communist influence than the unorganized laborers elsewhere. The communist government now is very cautious and careful. They're trying their best not to make any mistakes. We heard predictions all the time that the government wouldn't last for 6 months, but it is managing to last.
But still, they took over the Christian schools as one of their first steps, didn't they?
Yes, they did. Now, that too, I can only explain or try to explain in this way, that I think in many cases, the Christian missions, though they did it with good intentions, yet failed to set forth the character of Christianity sufficiently, and identified themselves too much with social service and Western culture. And as soon as the government could promise the same things that the missions did, the people felt that they owed they didn't owe the allegiance to the Christian missions, and swung over to the communist side. And I was surprised, too, that there wasn't more reaction against the taking over of the schools by the communist government. In fact, they've gone this far that they have said that the schools, even our own schools, can fill only a certain number of places, that is, a certain number of desks in the school with pupils of their own choosing. They have to take out of the community that they have to take a certain percentage out of the community regardless of whether they're Christian or not. And so quite a few of our schools have more Hindu and Mohammedan children than they do Christian children. And most of the missions are thinking of abandoning their schools on that account.
Well, Dean Schiffler's been trying to get in here, but I mean, you have one loaded question here.
Does the division among the churches in Kerala contribute to this state of affairs? In our Ascension Day statement, remember, we confess to the wrong of unnecessary organizational division. Would this be a part of the problem?
The experience that I've had wouldn't indicate that. The missionaries have much to say about the forces of Hinduism. They usually speak of it as a sea of Hinduism, Mohammedanism, and Shintoism or Buddhism, depending upon the country, that engulfs them. But these other religions also have so many sects that I don't think it serves as an offense to them, the fact that people worship in different places on Sunday morning. I think what does make quite a bit of difference is that the individual Christians don't understand each other better, and say as individuals and as citizens don't work together more closely. And I would feel that the remedy should be sought, first of all, in that direction. Just to give an example, the police chief in Nagercoil, who is a Hindu, told me about the congressman from that territory, who is a Christian, and who is insisting, for instance, on various acts of nepotism in his part. Now, that's the type of thing that hurts the Christians, that the Christian ethic is not put into practice in the private life of the Christians enough.
Thank you very much.
I'm a little confused here. You said these schools were taken over by the communists. That means all of our schools were taken over also?
No.
Or is this a different problem?
No, I guess I agreed to something which I hadn't listened to carefully enough. No, the schools have not actually been taken over by the government. That is, the mission schools haven't. But the enrollment policies have been dictated by the government, and also some of the operational policies. For instance, if a mission now wants to discontinue a school, it has to make application to be allowed to close a school, and that permission will not be granted before 2 years. So for 2 years, regardless of anything, you'll have to conduct the school with the children who are there, and then your application may be granted, or it may not be granted. You see, the communist government doesn't want suddenly to be faced with a terrific increase in taxation when the mission schools are closed and all the children are thrown on the state.
You mentioned also that the schools were fitting too many social needs and not enough religious. Where did this breach occur, or could you just speak to this? I mean, I've read in books about this bad policy of building up a school for its own self, rather than contributing to the Christian witness in the community.
I suppose we have to be careful in judging the missionaries and the men of the past. I always have an uneasy feeling when I do that, because I wonder now what are people 30 years and 60 years from now going to say about the things that we did or didn't do. But as it appears now, I would say that, again, though well-intentioned, I am convinced that the mission policy of, frankly, trying to recreate in an Oriental country a Western type of church administration, that's what it really amounted to, a type of organization of congregation with the same type of officers and the same type of administration as we have here, and that means then also to transplant immediately the educational system, was not the thing to do. I think that the approach which is being made now, indicates that a school is something that should grow out of the Christian community rather than be brought in from the outside and transplanted there, is probably right. And that in order to get pupils into the schools originally, the missionaries would feed them and clothe them and take care of all their physical needs. It was easy to get pupils, but it really didn't serve the purpose of building the church.
How does this compare with our recruitment for theological schools? How do we get our theological students at that level?
Well, that varies in the different countries. In India, the system at present, or in the past, I think it's in the process of changing just now, has been that young men who showed promise when they were in elementary and middle school were engaged as catechists, perhaps with a little additional training, and then were sent out as paid catechists to the congregation, where they would do the instruction, perhaps teach school, also small village schools, and conduct services. And then as the leaders, the missionaries, and the other Indian pastors later on, observed these catechists in action and found some that evidently had the ability and the desire to study for the ministry, these catechists would be sent to the seminary. Now, that is an interesting thing, because then they continue on the payroll of the church, I think with just about full pay, because after all, most of them are family men, and so that the seminary was largely populated by men on the payroll of the church, having their families there also at the seminary. But that's in the process of changing now, as they're also raising the standards. I think the admission to the seminary now requires at least 1 year of college, one preparatory year for the seminary. In the Philippines, the program is somewhat similar. Promising young men are selected. However, they go immediately from the equivalent of junior college to the seminary. In Japan, young men are selected during their university years. There are quite a few large universities in Tokyo. I was told that there are well over 100,000 university students in the city of Tokyo alone. And promising young men are selected as college students. They have the privilege of living in the Lutheran Center in Tokyo, where they receive guidance for their studies and also begin a type of field work in the congregations in and around Tokyo. And then they are chosen for the theological study, so that the Japanese men are all university graduates before they begin their seminary training.
How do the enrollments of the various schools compare? What is the size approximately of our school in India?
In India, including the preparatory class, there were about 50 students this last year, just a few less. But I think the preparatory class had about 20, and there were three regular seminary classes, you see. The other seminaries have, on Formosa and in Tokyo,
about a dozen or so. And in the Philippines, there were 6 students, 4 in residence and 2 in the vicarage.
Well, how many did that mean you graduated in India, for instance?
About 8 to 10 a year, I imagine.
In Tokyo, we have...
There were 2 that were graduated this year. The commencement exercise were on Easter Sunday. And I think the next class has only 1. And then the following class has about 9 or 10.
Now, where do these men go? Is our church growing in the same proportion that we will have the need for these men in the field? Now, well, India, obviously, we can take care of them.
Well, I'm not sure that that's so obvious. There, the entire mission picture and pattern comes in. Now, I realize I'm, you notice I don't mind saying just what I think here. In the discussion groups, then probably some of the things that I say here will be challenged, but that's all right. That'll just furnish good discussion. I feel that we'll have to take a long, hard look at the church in India. Manifestly, if we would want to pour in, instead of the $500,000 that we put into India now a year, if we'd want to put in $750,000 or $500,000 or $2 million, why, we could build more churches, we could send more missionaries out, we could train more pastors and so on. But whether that is the thing that will really build the church in India, I think that's open to serious questions. I think what is needed there is probably also a survey to see just what progress the church in India can make towards not only making its own decisions for which we send the money to pay them, but also to come to some financial stability or at least financial maturity to begin to support its own work better. And I think that would mean then that perhaps we'd not train quite as many pastors and not have nearly the number that we have now of native workers on the payroll, but to have many more what we call volunteer workers, people who have an occupation and then who give time to the church, and perhaps have the pastors then administer or serve a group of congregations which can eventually support them. So I don't know just how long it will take to say to make the necessary studies to determine just what course the program should follow in these various countries. I am, however, convinced of this, that regardless of anything, we need to train and train very well a number of men in each country who can furnish the theological leadership.
May I tie up with this? Certainly, everyone over here realizes that we need trained leaders, but in general, your remarks just now have been indicating about the same direction in which our various mission boards have been moving, namely toward greater indigenization, a policy of far more enthusiastic assuming of responsibility for their own support, their own evangelistic outreach by the peoples themselves. What is your feeling after having been through Asia? Do you feel that most of our missionaries understand the details and the implications of the indigenous church policies towards which our mission board, I see Dr. Kuppelman out there this evening, and these things have been discussed in the Board of Foreign Missions. They've just gotten out a new manual embodying many of these things. Do you think that the missionaries generally understand and appreciate them?
Well, I think that varies also in the different countries. Much depends upon the leadership. In Korea, I am confident that they do. I think in Japan and in the Philippines also, there are a number of men who are taking the lead in this respect. Against the background of India, where we have been following the other policy for some 60 years, or almost 60 years now, I think it's understandable that the men would be rather apprehensive, and that includes not only the missionaries, but also the national pastors, and to some extent, of course, to the extent that the Christians, the individual Christians, understand the program, also them. So I think quite a bit of educational work will have to be done there, and due caution will have to be exercised. But I'm confident that the program should be promoted, and that we should make all deliberate speed in achieving it.
What's the biggest difficulty? I'll be going out in foreign missions myself in a couple of months. What's the biggest personal difficulty that you notice in talking to missionaries about getting into this business of indigenous church, assimilating themselves into the culture?
I suppose the fact that we have in recent years made these success stories, in quotes, so popular. That is, a candidate goes out from the seminary, he goes into a suburban area where there isn't a church, perhaps not even very many homes as yet. The homes are built by the scores and by the hundreds, and the people come flocking in, and lo and behold, in 5 years he has a self-supporting church that either already has a complete plant or is on the way towards getting one. Now, you see, when we make so much of that here, you can't blame the missionary if he, in the back of his mind, has that same picture, that that's really the thing to be achieved, to have a good church building with an active congregation, to have that as quickly as possible. Now, on the plan of working for an indigenous church, that's a long time in coming. You see, for a long time, you have to meet in the homes of the people, and you can't think of an organized congregation in the sense in which we have it here. And to have the church then acquire, or the congregation acquire a piece of property, also, even that will take years to accomplish. So I think that to get an entirely different mindset, I might say, as to what the goal is in this evangelistic work that the missionary is doing, is one of the big difficulties. Now, once that's overcome, I think that the joys of the work will be, just to say, they're even greater for the missionary who does that type of work than for the other.
How big a contribution do our service people make to worldwide program? I'm thinking of chaplain particularly.
A considerable contribution where we have them. For instance, in Korea, I think our men are very grateful for the work of the chaplains. There were three or four there at the time when I was there. Chaplain Rice had just been transferred, and it gives them additional contacts. It enables them also to secure a few little privileges, such as for instance, an APO address. It gets them in contact with more Americans. They can occasionally conduct a service for the chaplains, and they realize that they're rendering a service there. And also our service personnel in Hong Kong, when a ship comes into the harbor at Hong Kong, then the sailors find their way to our churches, either in Kowloon or on the island of Hong Kong. And there are always a number of them that leave a very fine impression, and that through what they say and what they do, serve to strengthen the national church there, too.
Have they built any orphanages, our fellows?
I don't know whether they've done that much. I know that they have done quite a bit in support of various projects that are carried on, both on Formosa and in Hong Kong. Of course, in the Philippines, there aren't as many. And in India, I didn't meet any at all.
Yeah, I just interject a question here. Did you find any lay people of our church here at home, of whom we have thousands overseas now in various capacities, carrying on an active program of personal witness or evangelism in conjunction with our mission anywhere?
Yes, there were some. I didn't get to meet any who are permanently located in any of the countries, or at least located there for several years, who could carry on a program. But I noticed in Tokyo, for instance, that some of the service people, also some of the, naturally some of the civilians that are there in the employ of business firms or also of the United States government, do quite a bit in furthering the program of the church, also in the service that they personally render.
In preparing men for the ministry, you mentioned before that one of our great needs is to prepare the leaders, and I suppose you meant also the future theological professors as well as the church leaders. What are we doing, however, to strengthen or to give them that backlog of thorough indoctrination and understanding of the biblical language and the confessional standards? In other words, what are the books from which they can draw? Unless English is used predominantly.
Well, there isn't too much literature in any of the national languages, and I think that is one of the programs that we should foster very aggressively, for which we should train both men of our own, or men and women of our own, and also men from the various nationalities. Now, just how to begin that, I'm not in a position to say at this time, but it's a fact that very little has been translated into the Asiatic languages. I'm not sure that there's a complete translation of the Lutheran confessions in any of them, at least not a good and readable translation of them. The men in Japan and in India and on Formosa are working at that now. And then, you see, beyond translation, we need also indigenous literature, and there's very little of that. In Japan, the Lutheran groups have organized a Lutheran Literature Society of Japan, and I take off my hat to those folks. They have made a very good beginning. They're in tremendously crowded quarters. They hope soon to be able to build a new building. They have the property already. And they're going to work, for instance, on a translation of Luther's work, too. Now, not the entire Weimar edition, manifestly, but they're quite ambitious about it. But the main program that they have is to endeavor to develop Japanese authorship and to support the work of Christian authors in Japan.
What about popular literature for the lay people? You know, the periodicals?
Yes.
Educational literature?
Yes, there are periodicals everywhere. Now, I don't know whether there are any periodicals in the vernacular in the Philippines, because in Manila it's very largely in English. That is, our work is carried on very largely in English, and other languages are used up in the northern province and down south. But otherwise, we have Chinese publications and Japanese and Malayalam and Tamil publications. I wasn't able to judge the quality, manifestly.
Does that include such things as Sunday school literature, too?
Yes. Sunday school literature, devotional literature, and then some help, particularly for lay workers, for Sunday school teachers and for congregational officers and so on.
What do they do for illustrations in the Sunday school literature?
They get the old ones from CCA.
I'm afraid that's what it is. They usually get the old ones.
You didn't hear that. Oh.
They get the old ones from Concordia Publishing House, Dr. Charles.
Well, how does that strike an Oriental to see Jesus, the typical fat-cheeked European boy?
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that they have somewhat been conditioned to that. They've never seen anything else. But national art is beginning to come into its own. Now, we've had pictures here, too, at our exhibits of Johnny Sheck. He's a Chinese artist, isn't he? I saw some of his stuff over there, too. And his illustrations have been used. And I think our folks in Hong Kong are planning on literature which will use Chinese illustrations to a much larger extent. Now, Christmas cards, for instance, I think they use almost exclusively with native or national motifs.
That is Japanese, isn't it?
Yes, also in India and Hong Kong and Formosa.
You just corrected yourself. You said native, then you changed it to national. Why did you do that?
Well, I suppose from the folks over there, I developed an antipathy toward the word native. I suppose you don't have to drive it to an extreme, but we can understand, I think, why they don't want to be called natives, because they regard that as an expression from the time of imperialism, and they would rather be called nationals than natives.
Last World Mission Day last quarter, when you were gone, Dr. Steele had the chapel address, and he said something about, it seemed to him, did you hear it? He said that he thought there ought to be language studies here for these various countries. What do you think?
That's the type of question we all enjoy, isn't it? Well, now I can make that very easy. I can say we should have it in both places. We should have it here and abroad. I can answer it in this way, however, that when I was in Hong Kong, or rather in Macau, the Portuguese colony of Macau, which is near Hong Kong, and I went to the border of Red China and just stood there and looked across and saw the Chinese garrison and the Chinese flag a few hundred yards away, then I began to wonder about the 650 million Chinese who are, as you say, behind the bamboo curtain, and what we can do for them. Now, manifestly, we can train men and women who can learn the language and who can begin to do literary work in Chinese. We can train them on Formosa or in Hong Kong. But then I thought of the country beyond that, the Russia, for instance, and I felt, too, that in answer to our prayers, God may very well open up Russia to the gospel and give an opportunity to preach the gospel there, and we should be ready for the time that God will do that. I believe that some of us should learn the Russian language and should read the Russian literature so that we can understand the thought patterns and the culture and the background of the Russians, so that when it is possible to send literature there or to print literature over there, Christian literature that is, that we have some people who are ready for that. Now, I imagine that we'd have to train them here. So I do believe that in whichever way it's done, whether it's here or there, we should aggressively follow the program, particularly for these very two large segments of the population of the Earth. Now, have I answered the question?
I'm wondering if it would be possible to have an area, the area left here in Russian or Hebrew?
Well, I can mention that Michael Finkline, whom some of you will probably remember, who is now a missionary in Jai and who is part-time instructor at the seminary there, who is instructor in Hebrew, told me to tell the folks here that if they only would study Hebrew properly, it wouldn't be difficult at all.
Well, did you experience in your travels now a unity in the church, which is somewhat different in dimension from a cultural unity? And that leads up to the next question. What is the effect of, let us say, racial tensions like Little Rock on world missions, as you observe?
Well, I didn't observe too much effect in India, again, very particularly in this group of teacher-trained students that I faced. Pointed questions were asked about Little Rock and about the racial situation in the country, but it seemed to me that the questions weren't addressed in a hostile way, and that the young people were open to conviction and were quite understanding. That is, they could understand why we have difficulties because they have their own also. And I might mention that it was very interesting to me to see what difference color makes also in the Asiatic countries. In India, for instance, one of the missionaries told me that he had passed a remark about a young lady who was either was passing on the street or was in the company, and he had said to someone that she was quite an attractive girl. And then the person to whom he was talking said, "Yes, but look how black she is." So that they noticed the difference, too, in the color. And in the Philippines, I noticed the same thing. But if one then talks to them and shows what is happening in our country and how, even though the progress has been gradual, it nevertheless is noticeable, most of them understand. I don't think that that has been too much of a hindrance in the work of the mission. I might say this. I didn't know what you had intended with your question, but there's no doubt about it. I think that every visitor to the Orient will bear out this fact that the various Christian groups are much closer to each other and understand each other better than they do here.
Which leads me back to the Lutheran Literature Society in Japan as another illustration of the fact that missionaries and people of different denominations, particularly within the same Lutheran family, are much closer than they may often be here at home. Our church is participating in that program over there. Would you feel, after having seen it in operation, that this is the kind of thing that we could legitimately and properly do?
Yes, very definitely, because it's a service to the entire Christian church in Japan, and naturally then to all of the Lutheran groups. It's the type of joint service that I think we should engage in. The rules are such that there is no compromise of principle whatsoever. The board of directors which decides on the publications, and each group is represented there, and a veto by any one representative would mean that the publication is not put out as a joint venture. If one of the other groups still wishes to publish that a book or tract or a pamphlet or whatever it may be, it can still do so. So I think that's a very fine venture, and that has helped very much in mutual understanding and in furthering the work of the Lutheran Church.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I hadn't asked before what he thought of what President Fairbairn thought about this. I wrote the significant clauses in that kind of thing.
In theological education, how do our schools compare with the other Lutheran and probably Protestant or theological seminaries in the area? Now, we had a wide variation, I understand, you indicated before, that in some places we have graduates which are practically equivalent to a high school graduate being accepted, while we have the other extreme in Japan where they are university graduates. Now, in the various countries, would you say that we are about on a par with the other theological schools in terms of ministerial training?
Yeah, without actually measuring point by point and establishing a scale, I would say that my impression is that we're slightly above average. We don't, in every case, surely have the best school. I'm speaking academically now and as far as facilities are concerned. But we have schools that are acceptable. And I must say, I was very much heartened by the fact that the men who are instructors there not only are faithful in their work, but also have the right kind of pride in their institution. And I don't think we have to take a back seat at all as far as the training program is concerned.
Are there many nationals in our faculty?
Not many. There are two in India. There's one in Japan. In the Philippines, there aren't any, and on Formosa, there aren't any. Now, the difficulty with these small seminaries is that usually there's one of the missionaries who is almost full-time, and he then is the president or director or whatever the title may be. And then in order to supply all the courses in the curriculum with teachers, he draws on other missionaries who also have congregational responsibilities. And that makes it very difficult to conduct the work properly.
How do you account for the fact that in New Guinea we don't have any theology school? Where do they get their pastors or missionaries? Is it entirely in the States? Or is it because of the level of civilization in business, New Guinea, and anything like that? I know they don't even have a native language written out yet in most cases. How do I know that missionary schools are here or not?
Because I could pass that one off very easily by saying I wasn't in the beginning. But my impression is that it's due to the type of a program that is that we have begun and that we're trying to build a church that is much more indigenous, and that therefore we're not at that point yet where the church itself will train the ministers, and perhaps where there aren't sufficient young men, or perhaps not any, who are of the level that they can begin theological training.
Curricula indigenous in this respect, that they give adequate place to the culture and the religions of the respective areas.
I think in Japan a good beginning has been made. In every semester, the Japanese religion and the Japanese culture, Japanese social structure and so on, Japanese literature, are reflected. But I think in the other countries, much more will have to be done, particularly in the Philippines. Now, I don't have everything in my fingertips. I don't have all the reports here as yet either. Some of the reports will come by mail. But my impression is that very little has been done in the Philippines and also on Formosa, in that respect.
So, what difference would you say you saw in the relationship between professors and students, the new seminaries, and the relationship between professors and students here?
The students were on time.
You represent a vested interest.
Really, not very much. That is fundamentally not very much different. I think our missionaries, as those that are serving on the faculties, have done a very fine job of winning the confidence of the students and of being very natural with them, and the students also. I noticed in Japan, of course, the extreme politeness that you can see everywhere. If you don't mind my showing this example in two, I saw a baseball game on television, and after the game was over, the two teams lined up opposite each other in two long rows, and the four umpires were at the end, and then they were standing there, and they all bowed. Now, our students don't bow that low before.
Do you don't bow?
Talking about students, what type of students do you think that we ought to be sending out into the foreign mission field? The world mission field, rather.
Bill, a while ago when you mentioned, or when the Prexy mentioned that the married students were on the payroll in India, I heard a shuffle out here. I thought they were on their way.
All right, now let's see. Your question.
Let me start over. Do you think that we ought to be sending the majority of our missionaries into the world mission field as brand new graduates of Concordia Seminary?
Is that loaded or not? No, I I don't think so. I think that for all the young men in the this year's graduating class who are here this evening, I want to be able to tell them, that I'm going to do my best that, to see to it that some of them get calls to foreign fields a few years from now. And I think that should be a pattern which is followed to a much greater extent. In the Orient, age is respected very, very much. And as one Japanese woman told me, she said, he's going to Japan. These young men whom you send over here are very fine young men. And she had nothing but praise for them. But she said the whole Japanese outlook is towards respecting age and to put older men into positions of leadership. And I think as the church becomes indigenous, we'll have to send more older men over there who can guide the pastors then and who can train the leaders in the church.
I take it then that you feel that most of the men going over in the future ought to have some kind of specialized talent or specialized training in addition to the basic training which they receive at the seminary.
Either that or should have demonstrated in their ministry here that they have particular abilities which are necessary in the foreign field. Now, it seems to me, and again, I realize it's easy to criticize, easy to see what's missing over there. Folks who come here and say what's missing at Concordia Seminary without any difficulty. But I feel that what is needed in India, for instance, is quite a bit of training of workers for evangelism, we'll say. And I think it would be good if, in some way or another, that type of program were sparked from over here.
What can we do as a seminary to bind this fellowship a little more close to ourselves and to one another? As faculty and students. Now, I know we have the little issue, Koinonia, and we have had incidental projects in terms of the graduating class of Tokyo, but is there anything in addition, beyond our prayers, that we can actually do to make them conscious of this outer form of the actual bond of unity which we have by our faith?
Offhand, I wouldn't know. No, I think some of those projects can be developed still further. The need of the libraries at all the seminaries is very great. I think that since English is the required subject everywhere, we can help quite a bit with English literature or helping them to acquire English books. And I think that our students could do is to help the libraries at the various seminaries or to do other things for the students. Most of them are quite poor and are unable to acquire adequate libraries for themselves. In India, for instance, purchases are subsidized, for instance, that they will receive quite a discount on Concordia Publishing House books, but even at that, they are unable to purchase them. So if we could do something, I believe that was done once too, that all of the members of a graduating class or perhaps of a student body were given a book or several books as gifts from our student body. I think that helps make matters much more personal. And then I think that the best thing we can do is to try through as much personal contact of people who have been over there to endeavor to get a good picture of what is involved so that we can, in our prayers also, be much more specific and, if you'll pardon the expression, pray more intelligently for these various groups.
One more question, Dean, for this one. Is the church really neutral in this Cold War? Is it a third party, or is it strongly Western, as it has been accused of?
That's rather difficult to answer. Now, I feel in India, where we have, some 12,000 or more communicant members, and we have over 100 Indian pastors, I don't think that the outlook of the church as a group now, if you want to say that, is decidedly Western. I think it's quite Indian. One notices, for instance, that quite a few of the students do not wear Western clothes, although many people in India do wear Western clothes. Quite a few of the students do not wear them. Some people have westernized their names. For instance, Bishop Manikam, whom we mentioned, is one of the few cases where father and son have the same name. There's a family name. Otherwise, there are no family names in India. And now one can tell that there is a trend away from that, also among our Christians. So I am confident that the church, as it grows, and as the individual person of the missionary and the missionary family moves more into the background, that the church is not specifically Western.
Would you agree that the duty to witness is a part of the Great Commission when our Lord said, for example, go ye and teach all nations, teaching them to observe all things? And in line with that, would you view sympathetically such ideas as helping a church like the Batak Church in Indonesia to develop a greater and better Lutheran consciousness?
Yes, I think we should do all that we can. Now, there again, one stands before a tremendous problem. The question is, how much can we do? Just last week, some of us were discussing the possibilities of work in Lebanon. We have a man who has been in Lebanon who's now at our Springfield Seminary. And the question is, what can we do there when we're just beginning in Korea and when we have all these other missions to support? How far can we reach out and how soon can we spread ourselves? It won't do that once we have started in the country, say like Korea, that then we draw back and conduct only half an operation there. I think if we've committed ourselves to that, then we have to send a full complement of men over there, and we have to give them what is necessary. And by the way, the beginning of a program on the indigenous plan is not necessarily inexpensive. A jeep, for instance, in Seoul would cost about $8,000, U.S. money. After all, the missionaries have to have means of transportation. Rents are terrifically high in Seoul. So what I'm getting at is that while we should be ready to witness everywhere, and we should look at every opportunity that offers itself, and should decide only very reluctantly and in the face of necessity, I might say, that we can't go into a door that seems to be open to us, manifestly we can't follow every lead. I would feel, with regard to your specific question, that if we can do something for the Batak Church, it would be a wonderful thing, because that is an indigenous church. It's an autonomous church. It's a church that supports its own work very large. I think it receives very little help, financial help, from outside Indonesia. And if we could strengthen their Lutheran character, I think it would be a fine thing.
Do either of you have any more important questions? If not, I've asked Dr. Furbringer to close our get-together here, his report, with a 2 or 3 minute exhortation to us, a witness exhortation from what he has seen and heard, what he feels is most urgent in our fulfilling our responsibility to our Lord Jesus Christ. As he finishes then, as you finish, would you have us rise and pray the Lord's Prayer to close? And let us pray the Lord's Prayer, particularly Thy Kingdom Come, but the whole Lord's Prayer to the goal of the mission. Then you will be accepted as your advisors around 8:30.
On Rogation Tuesday, naturally turn to the subject of prayer for mission, which is nothing new to us, and which we practice on the biblical basis of many a text, particularly such words of Paul, which he writes to the Thessalonians in the first epistle, "Brethren, pray for us," and in the second epistle, "Finally, brethren, pray for us that the word of the Lord may speed on and triumph as it did among you, and that we may be delivered from wicked and evil men, for not all men have faith." But I think we ought in this evening go beyond the thought of praying for the missionaries and for the Christians, our fellow Christians in the foreign countries. We have done that, we want to continue that, but there are other things also that need to be included in our prayer. I indicated before in response to one of the questions that all of us ought to be concerned about the church in foreign lands. And many of us ought to realize that perhaps the call will come to me to go into a foreign country and to serve my Lord there. I think that's a little different in this day and age of rapid transportation and communication from what it was perhaps 50 years ago to go to California or some other distant point in our country. So I feel that that has to be part of our thinking. And I think we need to transmit that to the members of our laity also, because we need a certain number of laymen also in our foreign mission work. So I believe that the word that Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, when he says, covet earnestly the best gift, chapter 12, when he writes that also should mean something for our prayer, and that in our prayer for ourselves and the part that we may play in the mission of the church to the world, we include prayers, for instance, to this extent that God would lead us to take captive every thought under the obedience of Jesus Christ. It seems to me that that is one of the great difficulties in the work of missions, that we so easily fail there, that we still have our own ideas, not only how things ought to go and how things ought to be done, but particularly also as to what ought to be said, so that we implore the Lord for that gift, that we take every thought captive to obey Christ. And then a second thought. Foreign mission work in some respect has become much easier. Distances are traversed very rapidly. Now the jet age is coming for planes. Was it tonight's paper or yesterday that said that a plane had crossed the Atlantic in 4 hours, the first time that that has happened with a civilian transport plane. So in many ways, it's much easier. The terms are much shorter, and people can visit their relatives much easier. And yet it seems to me, as I went through the mission fields and as I recall what I observed there, that is still one of the big difficulties in the minds of the missionaries and their wives and their families, this idea of a separation and this idea of missing out on something that's going on in the culture and the civilization and the church back home. So that I think among the gifts for which we earnestly ask our Lord is also this, that we learn of him, in his own words, to hate our own father and mother and wife and children and brother and sister, yes, and even our own life, so that we may be his disciples, and that we may learn, that we may implore him also for the gift to endure hardness as good soldiers of Jesus Christ. And then in the third place, that I think we need to remind ourselves that our prayer should include the prayer for others, for those who are not Christians, to a much greater degree. I'm thinking again of those many, many Chinese and all of the peoples behind the Iron Curtain, all the peoples who are living under governments that are inimical to Christianity, that we pray for them as Abraham pleaded for the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. I think that's one of the finest examples that we have of prayer for those who we might say need it the most because they are in danger of failing of salvation because of the wrath of God on their unbelief. So I would plead with you that as we pray for missions, we include not only our present colleagues and fellow Christians, but particularly ourselves for future service in the world mission field and those who are not yet obedient to the gospel. Now shall we rise and join in the Lord's prayer.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Can you see the other side?